Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half hour featuring unique personalities whose ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers Newark. And now, Conversations with Alan Wolper.
Michael Connelly is a best-selling mystery writer whose books often critique the American criminal justice system. His latest book, called Gods of Guilt, is part of his Lincoln Lawyer series, which features an idealistic, troubled criminal defense attorney who runs his practice out of the back of his Lincoln town car and will do almost anything to win a case. A lawyer who says there's no client as scary as an innocent man. Matthew McConaughey starred in the movie version of the first book of the Lincoln Lawyer series, called appropriately The Lincoln Lawyer. Michael Connelly has written 25 mystery novels, one nonfiction book, four e-books, and he's only 57 years old. His series on his fictional detective, Harry Bosch, is going to be made into a one-hour television pilot next year by Amazon Studios. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me back.
Why do you continue writing? What's that all about? Aren't you tired?
No, I'm not tired. Certainly not from the writing aspects of what I do. Other things get me tired.
Well,
you mentioned the one-hour pilot. We just finished filming that about a week ago, 10 days ago. And, you know, for someone who spends most of his life in a room by himself, sitting on a couch writing at his own leisurely pace, that was a big, big difference to be on sets for 14 hours a day and be on your feet most of the time.
Usually the film people take a writer and kind of discard him, throw him away. They didn't do that with you, did they?
For the most part, you're invited out of the process. But I held all the cards this time. It's rare that you can hold all the cards of Hollywood. And so I wouldn't let them go forward unless I was a big part of it and had a lot of approvals and okays. And it was one of these things where you can do it my way or we just won't do it because, you know, Harry Bosch means too much to me. I've been writing about him for over 20 years, and I'm not going to let this happen unless I have a major say in it.
Harry Bosch, you're going to have to describe him to our audience who don't know anything about him. Introduce him.
Well, he's a LAPD homicide detective. I should grab your introduction of Mickey Haller, idealistic but trouble. Is that what you said?
I did.
You know, he has a little bit of that in him. He's
And he also likes to play jazz.
Yeah, he's a guy who draws inspiration from jazz. He's a relentless detective. And he's overcome a lot in his life to do this work and appreciates it when he connects with somebody like a jazz musician who's overcome a lot to make their music.
And what did you want in this series that maybe another studio might not want, someone like Paramount, for example?
Well, Harry Bosch, you know, when you break down writing, there's the routine is to break it down into like plot, character, location, and I never break that stuff down. I think they're all mixed around one thing, and that's character. In these books, Harry Bosch is intrinsic to Los Angeles. It is a matter of business to film things that are about Los Angeles somewhere else because it's cheaper and there are tax credits and tax rebates. And so I would not make a deal with anyone unless it's set in a contract every shot would be shot in Los Angeles.
Usually up on a hill with Harry Bosch, right? Thinking about it from a house high on a hill.
He contemplates the city and his place in it, and there's been 17 Harry Bosch books. The single location that's been in every one of those Bosch books is his house and his back deck. The other locations are important, like police departments and so forth, but they've not been in every book. The only thing that's been in every book is his house, and so that would be a key location. And I wanted to pick that house, you know, so I assembled a team that let me have these kind of okays and approvals.
And the team, the man who stars as Harry Bosch is?
Is a character actor named Titus Welliver, whose name is probably not that well known, which is I'm glad about. But his face is also probably known to a lot of people who watch TV and movies. He's a journeyman actor. He's 51 years old. been in lots of stuff, lots of films, lots of shows like Deadwood, Lost, Sons of Anarchy. He doesn't, you know, not through the whole runs of these shows, but he'll come in and do a season, that type of thing. He was in Argo last year, the movie that won the Oscar.
Who picked him?
In a way, I did. We went through a casting process where many names were on a list for consideration as Harry Bosch. And I happened to have seen Titus in a show where I saw this relentless quality that was transmitted through his eyes. And something about when I saw him in this thing, in the show, made me think that guy might be a good Harry Bosch. So I put his name on the list. And it took several months before we actually got a chance to talk to him because he was in Hong Kong making a movie. But he came in. I would say the brain trust of the show is about five people. And he came in, and plus casting agents, and he came in and read from the script, or, you know, played the part from the script. And we talked to him for a little bit, and then he left. And we all looked at each other and said, that's Harry Bosch. And our search ended that minute.
City of Bones. That's the book that is going to be, well, mostly based on, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is to serialize the stories over a season, a 12-episode season. And the main or the A story is City of Bones case. That will go through all 12 episodes where we're grafting on a key part of another book I wrote called Concrete Blonde, in which Harry is sued in civil court for civil rights accusations of civil rights violations, in which he killed a suspected serial killer. And we're taking that trial and putting that into the story as well as a means of exposition, because the books are very internal and we are looking for ways of seeing who Harry is and what his history is. And there's going to be no better way than to put him on the stand and under oath and ask him questions. So we'll do that in the trial.
Who's City of Bones? What is it?
City of Bones was chosen. It's not the first book. It's actually somewhere in the middle of the series, but it was chosen as the best way to introduce Harry Bosch as a television show, because it's a case that has two things going for it. One is the procedural aspects of it. It unfolds in a chapter. You know, it's a book, so it unfolds in chapters, but we can see that unfolding in episodes in the show. But it also is one of the cases that really, I think, reveals Harry's character, because it's about these bones of a 13-year-old boy being found in the hills of Los Angeles. And they've been in the ground for a long time. And the bone, all there are bones, but there's enough injuries on those bones that we know this child led a pretty torturous life of abuse. And that connects to Harry. Harry had a very difficult childhood. He was orphaned. He went through all kinds of failed social institutions, foster homes, and all these things. And as he works on this case, he connects to this kid who, all we have are bones. Finally, he identifies the kid and has a picture. But as the steps go along, he gets more and more involved in an empathic connection to the victim. And, you know, that's the kind of emotional track that we want to get into this show. And we think that that is what will make people connect to the show.
It also has takes a few very well-aimed pot shots at the media and the way it covered the demise of someone in that book. I guess no sense holding back someone who commits suicide because he was convicted in the court of public opinion.
Right.
He didn't do anything.
Yeah, there's a whole aspect of I would say the whole Bosch series, but in this book in particular, about the media and kind of like the unbridled media, the media I was a part of. And so
At the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, I worked at the LA Times for a long time.
Florida.
And so this is this will have that aspect. That's, you know, the pilot, all we have shot is the pilot. But we have the aspects of that already starting with a reporter on Harry's case as Harry's working his own case.
Harry Bosch is kind of a philosopher. You know, he'd be a terrific police commissioner, although he'd probably be fired after about two or three days because he can't stand the hierarchy. Is that you?
I don't think to the same extent as Harry. I mean, I kind of have built Harry and I know what makes him work. And I think, you know, every book he has obviously a task in front of him solving a murder. But I like putting obstacles in the way, and bureaucracy, government bureaucracy, not only is a way for me to show his character, but it's also a way of connecting these books to the reader, because we all have frustrations with bureaucracy, whether it's, you know, political bureaucracy, government bureaucracy, or corporate bureaucracy, wherever we work. And I think these are ways that you can connect reader and protagonist. You know, you see how the protagonist deals with bureaucracy or doesn't, how he goes under it, around it, over it, right through it.
Especially and, these and days. Connect. Especially these days, it seems like we're overrun with bureaucracy.
Yeah, yeah, and the lack of the intransigence of politicians and so forth is, you know, I think it does add up to this world of, you know, bureaucratic entropy that is something people will see in these stories and connect to.
You are Los Angeles-centric. We understand that. And there's someone who was a former police commissioner in Los Angeles. Did you have any dealings with him, or you have any feelings with the way he was a police commissioner back out then?
Yeah, you're talking about Bill Bratton.
Bill Bratton, yeah.
Yeah, and when he opened a lot of doors for me because he was not from Los Angeles, and he was brought in as an outsider. One of the only two times they brought in outsiders to be police chief in Los Angeles. And lucky for me, someone had told him you should read the Harry Bosch books as one of your means of getting to know this place you're going to come run. And he did, and that made him reach out and make contact. And it was at a time I had Harry Bosch retire, and I wanted to get him back in the police department. And I said, is that possible under your regime as police chief? And he said, absolutely. And he actually sent me the real forms that Harry Bosch would fill out to come back to the department. And he just kind of opened a lot of doors for me. I think he also helped change the image of the department. He was kind of like the bridge from the dark times of the 90s to a more open and police department, which I think the public out in Los Angeles is slowly but surely welcoming back as not a kind of like a you know, almost like a military organization has taken over.
You're listening on the radio to Conversations with Alan Wolper on WBGO 88.3 FM, and we're being simulcast live on WBGO.org. Our guest is mega mystery writer Michael Connelly, whose most recent book, Gods of Guilt, is winning critical reviews everywhere. Michael, one of the ways to find out the kind of person a writer is, to check out the person he dedicates his book to. In Gods of Guilt, that person was the late Charlie Hounshell, a longtime friend from Florida. Tell us about him.
Tell
us about you, won't it?
What's that?
It'll tell us about you, won't it?
Well, maybe. Charlie was a person I met in college. And through him, I met the woman that I ended up marrying, my college sweetheart, still married to her. And she grew up next to Charlie.
That's Linda Connelly.
Yeah, Linda. And she grew up next to Charlie, and they were best friends since they were 2 years old. And unfortunately, he passed away unexpectedly earlier this year in New York City. And it was like kind of like a no-brainer. Sometimes I actually have difficulty thinking, who do I want to dedicate a book to? I've been fortunate that I've written a lot of books, so I got all the basics covered, like mother, wife, daughter. And so in more recent books, I have a lot of freedom to honor somebody who's important to me, honor someone who's passed away. But I didn't really have to think too much. Charlie was very important in my daughter's life. I have a 16-year-old daughter. She grew up with him as Uncle Charlie. Obviously, my wife's best friend. And he was also the kind of person that, more so than me, but I would like to be. He was a person who put other people first. He was involved in community arts programs and community education programs, and he's a real giver. Admired him for that.
Actually, some of the issues and themes in your book seem to be similar to the things you're interested in, like the Florida Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the Spring of Tampa Bay, Florida's largest domestic violence shelter, things mm-hmm. like that. Do you take any of that from him?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm involved in some of the same programs as him, and I wasn't leading the way. Charlie was more of the guy who would lead the way and bring his friends in for, you know, worthy worthy efforts. And, you know, I write about a guy, for the most part, this Harry Bosch, who, you know, to boil him down, he has a basic genetic code, and it said everybody counts or nobody counts. And I would say that really fits Charlie Hounshell to a T, and one of the reasons why the book's dedicated to him.
Do people ask you about that? Do they care?
About dedications? No, yeah. Not too often.
Why not? Why don't you think they care?
I don't know. Maybe they go past that page too fast.
But you spend a lot of time deciding who to dedicate the book to and why.
I just think, you know, hopefully they think it's a cool thing or they think it's an honorable thing. I mean, and so in many ways it's a thank you. I've dedicated books to detectives who have helped me, jazz musician who helped me, family members, obviously. You know, especially in what I'm doing, you know, right now I'm trying to get my 27th novel going. In some ways, inspiration is hard to come by. You say that do I get tired of doing this? I don't get tired of it, but I need to be inspired. And, you know, if you get inspiration from somebody, it's got a high value, at least to me. And so that might be the one reason why I would dedicate a book to somebody.
When I was reading Gods of Guilt, I was thinking about all the issues you're bringing. Let's see, we have things that you like lie detector tests that don't work, prosecutors who maybe don't show up, people who don't have money for bail. You seem like you've stuck them all in one book, every issue, every civil rights issue you can possibly imagine. And, of course, the wild, crazed Mickey Haller. Why? Why in this particular book did we get so many of these issues? We seem to, consolidate everything else before.
Well, I don't know. I think it all is all part of the system, you know. I've always viewed the books with Mickey Haller, the so-called Lincoln Lawyer books, as I just have, you know, I'm very visual in the way I write, and I have visual images that are kind of glancing images that underline my view of books. And I've always looked at Mickey Haller books as a guy looking up from the basement of a courthouse. Like he's in the trenches, he's down below the surface, and the surface being the idealism that most of us attach to our justice system. And this is a guy who's below that surface and is in it and knows how it works and doesn't work and he knows how to gimmick it, you know, how to work it. And so to me, that's a
system that's malleable, as you pointed out.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the key lines in the book. The law is malleable. It can be bent and formed in the way you want it to work.
If you want to get out there and sort of do that yourself, or are you going to just stick to books?
I think I'll just stick to books, and I'll stick to hanging around people who do that, and hopefully I'll have a continuing ear for their dialogue, which reveals a lot of this. The title of this book, Gods of Guilt, was just an offhand comment a lawyer made after he had lost a trial, a jury trial, and got a guilty verdict for his client. And he kind of, in a derisive manner, talked about the gods of guilt. And you know, he was obviously talking about the jury.
The jury. Do you have any gods of guilt yourself?
Oh, of course I do. I think everybody does. I mean, one of the points of the book is that we all have a jury. Everybody carries a jury around, and it's populated by the people that mean the most to them, dead and alive. And that is the double entendre of the title. It's, you know, obviously about it. There's a jury trial here, and Mickey, even in his opening statement to them, calls them the gods of guilt. But it's really a story about his own internal jury and him dealing with a lot of issues and you know, with the things that he's done and what it's cost him.
It's cost him a lot. Of course, people who are idealistic, it seems to me, pay a higher price than those who are not,
yeah,
especially
I mean,
in the criminal justice system.
Well, ideals die hard, I think. And I think, you know, it's tough. It's rare to find a criminal defense attorney, for example, that goes all the way. And when I say goes all the way, it means that he spends 40 years doing that or she spends 40 years doing that. Because it can wear you down because the ideals are gone and then it becomes a practice where every day I think you'd probably go home and wonder about what you're doing.
I interviewed actually Ricky Kleeman, you probably mm-hmm. know, and she said when she was a defense attorney in Massachusetts, there were two cases that she lost when she showed the people were guilty, innocent, excuse me, and she carried around ever since.
Yeah, no, that's pretty harsh. And then there's, you know, I've kind of examined that in The Lincoln Lawyer, and I think the heart of guilt that beats in this current story is quite the opposite. It's when he got somebody who's guilty, he knows he's guilty, and he got him off on a technicality and what happens after that. So
quite a technicality, but yeah. I think would have saved that for the readers.
Well, we won't have to talk about it.
No, let's not talk about it. And I'm sure you read the papers, you watch television, look at all these crime stuff. Is there anything different today than when you were out there beating, running around for the Los Angeles Times? Well, are we different in crime, the way we cover crime or write about crime?
I think so, because of the explosion of the internet and the importance of the internet now as a disseminating point for media. It makes things move quicker. I think it adds to a less thoughtful process, and it can, therefore, the end result is misinformation getting out. I have not been a reporter in almost 20 years, so I'm far removed from it. But there was a real price and pressure to what you put out be correct and not be updated and so forth. And that's not the way it is anymore. Like websites and so forth just put out whatever they've heard and then they update it and correct it as we're going. So the reading public, the viewing public is seeing a lot of the correction as we go.
It's strange because people who are as 16, 17 years old, didn't, I think to quote you, get out on the street and bang on doors. I'm being nice because you had a little more descriptive than that. Why aren't we interested in finding out what people say? Why do we continue, and why do you find that we continue to use electronic devices to communicate?
I don't know. I think there's a sense that they have immediacy when they probably don't. There is a false immediacy to it it's addictive in quality, because I'm sitting here trying to act like that's bad, but I'm the first guy who will be texting when I'm done this interview to see if I missed any messages or anything. So I'm part of that problem, if you want to call it a problem, or a cultural shift, if you want to call it that. I don't know why we do it. When it comes to the media, I think there's something missing. I miss all the tent poles. I miss how a newspaper could really be the center of community and social discussion, but now it's decentralized and pushed across, this amorphous thing called the internet.
It's not hard to notice that Harry Bosch barely can use his phone, although he's connected, but a couple of telephone numbers he needs, his daughter, things like that. But basically, what he wants to do is he wants to talk to people.
Yeah,
And you emphasize that theme in every one of your books, it seems to me.
So many real detectives tell me that the art of being a good detective is getting people to talk and listening to them. And so something like a phone, the internet, these are things that stand between Harry Bosch and doing that, going out, as you say, and knocking on doors and getting people to talk, because that's really how you solve cases.
And how you get information. That's the voice of mystery writer Michael Connelly on WBGO 88.3 FM. And WBGO.org, who is soon to share his literary world with Amazon Studios, which is producing a one-hour pilot film featuring two of your Harry Bosch books, City of Bones and The Concrete Blonde, which we discussed before. What is the process now? Once you've done a pilot, then what?
All right, so we have a pilot. Right now we're in the editing stage, so we don't know what we have. We sort of do. We've seen dailies and all that. But we'll spend the rest of this year putting this together, smoothing out the rough edges, adding music, and creating this pilot. We'll turn it over to Amazon in the early part of 2014. And what Amazon does, which no one else does, is they take their pilots and rather than internally test them with test audiences and so forth, they just put it up on Amazon video, where you can stream videos off of the Amazon site. And so this pilot, without any kind of guarantee that there will ever be a season, they will put this pilot up and people can watch it and they can, you know, rate it 1 through 5 stars and so forth. And that will become a part of the process that Amazon uses in deciding whether or not to go forward with the series.
That's freaky.
It's freaky because it's new, but from my standpoint, I'm not scared of it because Amazon sells more of my books than any place in this world. And so I think I can marshal the troops, so to speak. I can get people who are lovers of Harry Bosch books and want to see this, and I can get them to look at that. And I think I'm going to swamp them with 5-star reviews.
Harry Bosch Brigade, huh?
Yeah. I'm counting on them, you know, in when this goes up. It'll probably go up in March.
And what will it tell people about Harry Bosch, basically, that they don't already know in the other 15 or 16 books that are 14?
Well, you know, I mean, there's some new stuff. It's based on City of Bones. It takes from in a big way from Concrete Blonde. It takes in a small way from about 4 or 5 other books. But also, if you look at our tasks, what we had, Harry Bosch ages in real time. He's been around for 20 years, so we've seen him go from 42 to 62. This show is going to be based in contemporary LA. We chose an actor who's 51 and probably is playing like 48, 49. So it's a bit of a different Harry Bosch. If you're reading my more recent books and think that's who you're going to see, it won't be the same guy.
It's almost like writing a new book for you.
In many ways it is. I mean, over those 20 years, Harry's had multiple detective partners, he's had multiple romantic partners, he had multiple supervisors, and we got to pick who we wanted, which were the best characters to present in this very first season or very first pilot. And so it's kind of a mix and match of the show. Here's an example of something. Very intrinsic to Harry Bosch's character is that he spent time in Vietnam. Well, in the war. If you're going to have a 51-year-old actor in 2013 LA, that actor is not old enough to have been in Vietnam. So we lose that very important part of Harry's history, and we have to find a way of replacing it because it's a reverberation that goes through his whole life.
All of his nightmares, the tunnels that he dealt with,
right.
the Viet Cong, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the tunnel, for the all-in inscription, I call it the tunnel. We need Harry to still have tunnels in his dreams. And I'm not going to go into how we solved that, but I think we did solve it, and we have a credible history, alternate history to the history that's in the books, so that you still have the same kind of Harry with the same kind of troubles and the same kind of dedication and questions and so forth.
I noticed recently that someone had retired, and you wrote a little, kind of a goodbye to the guy. He was a police chief, or he was a police sergeant, and you were saying that that Harry Bosch was based on this particular character. How many real-life detectives do you use as examples of who Harry Bosch is?
Well, one guy, the guy who retired, his name is Rick Jackson, and he retired after 35 years, 29 in homicide. And on his very last day, he wanted to go to the crime scene of his first murder because he never solved it. And so I drove up. It was up in the hills, and I went with him. The other guy who is very close to and very helpful is a detective named Tim Marsha. And then his current partner is a detective named Mitzi Roberts. And so between those three, I pretty much get what I need. They have the entree to get me to other detectives or whoever else I need. So it's not just those three, but they're the three main.
Michael Connelly, congratulations on Gods of Guilt, the latest of your books in the Lincoln Lawyer series. I think the world would be a better place if people were somehow able to communicate with their Gods of Guilt. Thanks for sharing your life with us.
Thank you.
Joanna Walper is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is the executive producer. Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer. If you missed any part of our program, you can hear it all again on WBGO.org or subscribe to us on iTunes. Until we talk again, I'm Alan Walper.
Special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District, and support for Conversations with Alan Walper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.